Good morning, everybody. Thank you for choosing to come to this session. We certainly appreciate it. The good news is because we filled the room, we were able to start early. So I'm not sure if that's a good thing. It means I can either finish this session faster or we can bore you a little longer. Hopefully we can't do both. So let's proceed with this. As Jody said, we see this as a really exciting thing. I'll take the disclaimer as read. We invest thematically. We've been doing that fairly successfully since 1986. And what we're looking to do with our thematic ideas is to have returns above and beyond the MSCI, typically that are 3-5% over rolling three-year periods. And we do this with the idea of inevitability acting as a tailwind to support these themes. And global agribusiness has some amazing inevitabilities. It's these five things that I'm putting up on the screen now. We see these as basically inevitable, unstoppable forces. This is far bigger than a credit crisis that's occurring at the moment. If we look at global population, we're at 6.6 billion people now. We're going out to 8 billion people by 2021. That's 80 million new mouths to feed every year, roughly 8 people every 3 seconds. We just simply require more food. There's no escaping that. The most exciting thing, though, in all of this is the rising incomes. And I'm not talking about mega wealthy people here. I'm talking about people that are just coming from $1,000 a year and they're moving up to $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 a year. Why is that important? At $1,000 a year, you consume everything, all of that money on food and shelter. There's simply nothing more to spend on food. But as these incomes rise, these people spend a substantial amount of that extra income on more food, better quality food, and there's a shift in diet from cereals to higher protein diets. Now, you might think that this would free up demand for cereals. There'd be more cereal available, but it isn't. It actually requires about 8 to 9 kilos of grain to produce a kilo of beef. It requires about 4 kilos of grain to produce a kilo of pork. So as we're seeing this increase in protein, we're seeing exponential increases in demand for cereals. And this is driving up the cost of food all around the world right now. We have 3 billion people in this sweet spot, 1,000 moving up to 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000. That's almost half the world's population. And they're creating unprecedented demand, not just for food, but for energy and for hard commodities. And this is part of the inflationary story as we move through this current crisis. And out the other side, these 3 billion people aren't about to disappear. We have a limited amount of agricultural land, the third point. This is incredibly important because we can't just create more agricultural land. If you think about it, most of the good land is being used already for agriculture. Sure, we can cut down more lowland rainforest, more lowland temperate forest, but then you get more problems with global warming and climate change, and we simply don't want to go around down that road. So we'll assume we have a finite amount of land. We don't. It's actually in decline. It's in decline because of urbanization. Think about where the world's major cities are. They actually started as villages in the middle of great agricultural areas, typically. The cities across Europe, Sydney, Melbourne, Beijing, Shanghai, all of these have consumed a huge amount of agricultural land. If you look at Tokyo and Yokohama, they basically sit in the middle of one of the world's great rice-growing regions, the Kanto Plain. That's eaten up. So we're losing agricultural land through urbanization. We're also losing agricultural land through salt degradation, the encroachment of deserts. These are big problems. Obviously, salt degradation in Australia, in Africa, the United States. It's a particular problem in China, particularly in the Beijing Basin. It's usually to do with cutting down too many trees. It allows the water table to rise, and we get salt encroachment with that. The other place where desert is a big problem is in China as well. And if you think about the amount of agricultural land and you look at the increase in the population on a per capita basis, the amount of agricultural land is in very serious decline. And I'll show you a chart on that shortly. Added to this mix, we've got the madness of biofuels. And I say madness because biofuels from food are driving up the cost of food. There's no doubt about that. The World Bank has come out with a report that suggests that 70 to 75% of the increase in food prices is because of the impact of biofuels. The Bush government has another paper that they've presented that suggests it's only 3%. Now, the World Bank one seems to have looked at the linkages in far more detail than the Bush government one, and I suspect that if you just look at biofuels, it's fairly logical that they have forced up the cost of food. If we look at the United States and Europe, we have legislation in place that means that biodiesel in Europe is going to continue, and of course ethanol production in the United States is going to continue as well. Last year, the Bush government passed an act, the Ethanol Fuel Bill Act. The United States is going to move from 5.5 billion gallons of ethanol they produced last year to 36 billion gallons by 2021. 5.5 to 36. That's a huge increase. Half of that can come from food crops. Most of it's going to come from corn. So it's hardly surprising that the cost of corn has risen quite dramatically. Global warming is a longer-term issue. Clearly, as that occurs, it's a problem for agriculture. It's more longer-term in nature, as I said, but we are seeing more intense hurricanes like Katrina. We're seeing more intense hurricane seasons. We're seeing snowstorms in southern China, floods in Europe, floods in the Midwest. All of these things seem to be more volatile and violent climate events, and we can expect more of these, it seems, as we go forward. So all of these things act as tailwinds to support the whole idea of global agribusiness, and this is something that makes it investable. Just quickly, most of the population growth is in the developing world, obviously in Asia, across India, the Middle East, countries like Indonesia, and of course Latin America. If we look at the relationship between income and extra food intake, this chart is a little complicated. It's just looking at the extra amount of food or protein, which is on the vertical axis. We have income per capita in US dollars on the horizontal. And the key point is, at $1,000, people don't eat any more food because they simply can't afford to. But you can see in this area here, as these incomes rise up to 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, there's a substantial increase in the amount of protein that people eat. Now, we have 3 billion people in the world in that sweet spot now. We've broken this up into developing countries, developed countries, income levels essentially up to $1,000, $1,000 to about $3,500, and $3,500 to $10,000. You can see there's 2.5 billion people in the middle group, and basically we're interested in all of them. The top end of this group, where there's 2.8 billion people, and the bottom end of this group. Clearly over 3 billion people on the planet that are in this spot now. Now, these people have the same wants and aspirations as all of us. And as I say, this is an inflationary trend. They all want somewhere to live. They want an apartment. They want a house. They want a motorbike. They want a push bike. They want a car. They covet the same consumer goods that we want. They all want to eat well. And this is creating unprecedented demand, as I said earlier, for soft commodities, hard commodities, and energy. As we come out of this downturn that we're going through at the moment, these people aren't going away. If we look at farmland per person, back in 1950, most people don't realize we only had 2.5 billion people on the planet. We had 1.3 billion hectares then, which meant there was half a hectare per person. Right now, we're at about 6.6 billion. We're below 0.3 of a hectare per person. By 2020, we're going to be probably under 0.2 of a hectare, because some population estimates have us at 8 billion people by then. Now, 0.2 of a hectare is an area. A hectare is 100 metres by 100 metres. 0.2 of a hectare is 20% of that. That is a very small amount of land on which to sustain one person for their entire lifetime. It's about twice the size of this room. And that's going to be a challenge. So companies that can help to enhance the yield from land, can help with water, can help with agrochemicals, better seed technology, all of these things stand to benefit in this sort of environment. This just looks at urban sprawl. It puts it in perspective. This is Kuala Lumpur in 1974. Same satellite photo taken just over 30 years later. And you can see quite clearly that sprawl. I visit Kuala Lumpur fairly regularly now as I live in Singapore, and basically I can tell you since 2005 the satellite development around Kuala Lumpur has increased way beyond that. That's just an example of land being lost. Now Malthus predicted that we'd all starve when the global population reached about 1 billion people in 1790. Well, 1790 he predicted it. Now clearly that didn't happen. And it didn't happen because all the way through human history, we've increased the yield from land. And we'll do it again. I'm convinced of that. I mean, if people in Australia can grow marijuana hydroponically in the roofs of houses, there's clearly scope to grow food that way if we have to. I'm not suggesting or condoning growing marijuana. But basically, you can see here a number of different sub-regions, and we've got yields from land from 1967 in the dark grey, the blacks 82 to 97, and the lighter grey is forecast from 97 out to 2020. Now the key point in all of this, you can see that the actual yield is declining in most of these areas. It's coming down. It's not going up. So the yield is still positive, but the second derivative, the rate of change, is in decline. And this is very important. You think, why would that have happened? Well, we had obviously some big breakthroughs. We had the amalgamation of small farms into bigger ones, better mechanization, better yields from land. We've had better seed technology, better pesticides, better chemicals, better fertilizers. All of these things have helped. We've had laser leveling of fields. This has helped. All these things have made a big difference, but it's becoming more and more difficult to increase the yield now. There's some countries where it can obviously happen, China, India, that can be picked up, but it's a problem as we go forward. And if you look at the big seed companies, the Syngentas, the Monsantos, when they came out with modified seeds a decade ago, they were getting 30, 40% yield increases for some crops. When they bring them out now, they're only getting 3 or 4% yield increases. So this will be a challenge. So companies that can help here are going to increase in value. Water's a critical issue in all of that as well, obviously. Now we saw this new word enter the English language in April of last year, and it was agflation. We'd been talking about agricultural price inflation for a couple of years before this actually came out. But if you think about food prices, they've actually been in decline for almost 300 years as a percentage of what you pay out of your disposable income. The developed world pays about 12%, so as food prices rise, we don't notice it that much. It's not such a problem. But in the emerging world, it is a problem because it's a higher percentage of personal income. We believe that because of those five forces we just looked at, the rising population, the wealth effect, limited amount of agricultural land, biofuels, and of course climate change, these things mean that there's a turning point here. We think we've reached a tipping point about 2 years ago, and what we're likely to see is a long-term increase in the price of food, a secular trend, and secular trends are investable. We think it's likely to lead to significant long-term increases in the percentage that people spend on food, and we think we're at the early stages of that. If we just look at wheat inventories, this is the number of days supply of wheat over the last 10 years or so, and you can see it's come down quite alarmingly. We're actually consuming more grain over the last 2 years than we've produced, and this is clearly a problem. It's leading to inventory rundowns. If you look at corn prices, you can see the large increase here. Essentially what happened, we got corn down to about $2 a bushel. It doubled in price because of the ethanol industry starting up a couple of years ago. It went to $4 a bushel. Farmers are very clever people. What do you do if the price of something doubles? You plant more. So they did. They planted 17% more land to corn in the United States, and that caused that small price reduction. But after that, we've continued to see ethanol production increase. More demand. The farmers are subsidized. It's an election year this year. Nothing's going to change there. And basically, ethanol production is likely to increase, as I said, to 36 billion gallons, 18 billion of which are likely to come from corn. If you plant more land to corn, there's less land available for other things. So the cost of those other things has tended to rise. The cost of soybeans has risen. The soybean price has risen very, very dramatically. Another part of the reason why this is up so much is that China has moved from a net exporter of soybeans to be the world's largest importer. Why? China's using that soybean meal to feed animals in feedlots. And that's the best evidence I can give you of that income shift and the protein shift. Most of this soybean is going to come from Brazil. Brazil's set to become the biggest agricultural exporter in the world. All these things are used to feed animals, so the cost of raising animals has risen. It's been passed on to consumers. You can see higher prices for chickens, higher prices for beef. So all of these things are inflationary in nature, and we think over a long term, they're going to continue to rise. There'll be cycles around it, like drought in Australia affects the price of rice, it affects the price of wheat, but the long-term price rise is now in a secular uptrend. This looks at the awakening of agflation. There tends to be correlation between the various commodity cycles. Hard commodities tend to go up first. You get fuel, power, energy, metals and metal products, and agricultural products. And Robert Zoellick, who's the president of the World Bank, in a report in the Financial Times about 6 weeks ago, suggested that we're only at the very early days of food price rises. And that's because there's been massive underinvestment in global agribusiness for at least two decades. And it'll take at least 5 years, according to the World Bank, to turn this around. And that was before the Doha trade round was not signed. We need to sign the Doha trade round to fix this. It's a key problem. We can solve the impoverishment of people in Africa, people in South America. We need to abolish tariff protection. The United States should be importing ethanol from Brazil. It shouldn't be making it from corn. If we did this, we could allow sugarcane farmers in Brazil to increase their wealth. We could allow sugarcane to be grown in India, more of it, more sugarcane in Africa. And this would lay, instead of 3 billion new consumers, we'd probably have 4.5-5 billion new consumers. So all of these things are very important, but this is still investable as we go forward. Now, from an investment perspective, we published a paper last year at this forum looking at satellite products around mainstream global equity funds. And the key thing here is that if you get extra sources of alpha that have low correlation with other asset classes, it's a fantastic thing to put into a portfolio to diversify it. And this is certainly one of those asset classes. If we look at the correlation of various indices, commodities, we've got the Dow Jones AIG Commodity Index, S&P, Goldman Sachs, industrial metals, precious metals, agriculture, crude oil. And clearly, with global equities, the MSCI has a perfect correlation with itself. It's got a correlation of one. But you can see those other commodities, particularly agriculture, have very, very low correlations. Now, we don't have an adequate global benchmark in global agribusiness. We were the first manager in the world to define this as a separate business. There's no such thing, for instance, as an MSCI Global Agribusiness Index. We invest in about 32 different sub-industries across the global agribusiness spectrum. So to put this in perspective, we've used our own fund as a proxy for a basket of agricultural stocks because there's no appropriate index to measure it against. But you can see our fund has very low correlation with the actual commodity indices. That's because we're investing in 32 sub-industries, not just companies that have direct commodity exposure. In fact, we're investing in some companies that benefit from falling commodity prices. Other companies just do well through grain handling, and that's a volume. It's got nothing to do with price. So we correlate not very highly at all with these commodity indices, but we also have a remarkably low correlation with the MSCI World Index. This is a global equity fund that we're talking about. It's got a particularly low correlation with the MSCI World Index. So again, commodities are good to have in a portfolio, but I think a portfolio of global agribusiness equities is also something that people could consider putting into a portfolio as a portfolio diversifier and indeed an extra source of alpha. What do we mean by global agribusiness? Well, we define it as everything from ag commodities to consumer products. If you like, everything from seed all the way through to the consumer's plate. As I said, it's a huge range of different sub-industries that nobody has really looked at before. We were the first people in the world to launch an agribusiness fund. It's centered on the farm. It's about these inputs on the left. Clearly, seeds and fertilizers, companies that we've had and could be included, would include Monsanto, Syngenta, the global seed companies, the major fertilizer companies, Potash Corporation, for instance. On the land and plantation side, we've had Australian agriculture in the portfolio, one of the world's largest producers of beef. IOI Corporation, a Malaysian palm oil company. Aquaculture is a very important part of all this. The UN predicts that demand for fish is going to increase by 20 to 30% out to 2020. We need that extra source of protein. Clearly, we can't plunder the seas to that extent. We just have no wild stock left. So aquaculture becomes critically important in this. There's expertise in aquaculture in Norway. We have some in Australia, and that fits into that part of the whole agribusiness area. I mentioned water, but clearly companies that can help with recycling, desalination, filtration, membrane technology, ultrafiltration, irrigation, all of these are going to be of huge importance as we go forward. I spoke at an agribusiness conference in China about 2 months ago, and there was an official from the Chinese government spoke in the session before me, and he admitted that China by 2020 will only have 70% of its water requirements for agriculture. And that's a key challenge for them there. Machinery is very obvious. It's the companies like John Deere, the tractor manufacturers, the harvesters, the plows, those sorts of things, the farmers themselves, people that lend money to farmers, and that whole chain of production from storage, transport, processing, marketing, distribution. And of course, biofuels are a key part in this now. The other thing we've identified as being important and we include in the agribusiness space are ports. There's a critical lack of global port infrastructure. It's affecting the price of energy. It's affecting the price of hard commodities with bottlenecks in countries like Australia. But it's also of critical importance to the global food business. Now, these are the major trade routes. I apologize for the flashing lights here. One of our people in New York thought this was a clever way of doing something. Let's just speed it up. You can see here, though, that there is a dramatic lack of port infrastructure. And I mentioned Brazil. The port of Santos in Brazil is the major port for Sao Paulo. There's a map of Brazil here, compliments of Google. The major soybean area in Brazil is a new area out in here called the Mato Grosso. It's a high plateau. It's ideally suited for growing soybeans. All of those have to pass basically through the port of Santos. Santos is the second largest port in the southern hemisphere. It's physically constrained. It is capable of a bit of expansion, and that acts as a toll road for everything that's going to pass through it. So this company's in a good position going forward to take advantage of that. Another thing we're looking at in this space is nutrigenomics. Nutrigenomics is a new science. Large food companies are just starting to get interested in this. With the unraveling of the human genome, it's now possible to look at that, analyze people's blood, and actually see certain gene types that are susceptible to different sorts of diseases. Some of these can be changed through diet. We've been talking to universities on the West Coast and East Coast of the United States for a couple of years now on this. It's early days. But basically, the global food companies are starting to sit up and take notice of this new science. So we see global agribusiness as an inevitable investment opportunity. Basically, we have these forces, the growing population, that very strong growth in the emerging world, particularly Asia. Urbanization is increasing incomes. It's increasing demand for food. People are living longer. We simply need more food. That's very simple. We have the rising incomes, 3 billion people coming through as new consumers, and that's been a huge part of this. Also, in the developed world, people are starting to eat better. They want better quality food. They want organic food, healthier food. That's a driving force as well. We have the limited resources, the scarcity of land and water, the yield that's actually still rising, but it is in decline, increased pollution, the vagaries of climate change, and of course biofuels. And all of these things we see leading to rising prices for agriculture and food-related products, but more specifically for investments, for companies. And that's what we're looking to invest in. So that's probably a shorter version of what I was going to talk about, but if anyone's got questions, I'll be more than happy to attempt to answer them. Thank you very much. I think, do we have a microphone?
One of the commonly asked questions is how do you, you know, allocate to this type of thematic investment in a broader international equity portfolio? Now, in the market at the moment, there's obviously various investment products that tap into themes. Some of these products are fairly diversified in the underlying themes. And themes tend to run over different investment cycles. Some themes play out over longer term, some shorter term. Some themes are more correlated to each other than others. Now, as an investor, why would I allocate to a single focus theme instead of a more broader thematic strategy where the portfolio manager can make the decision for me as to which themes look attractive on a relative basis?
No, thanks for the question. We are a thematic investor and we do run a global thematic fund which has 12 themes. Global agribusiness is one of those. We found this idea so compelling that in September 2006, we launched this as a separate fund. But as I said, you need to have, well, Australians are very good. We're leading the world, basically, at investment in terms of constructing portfolios for clients. I think we're at the cutting edge of this. And most Australians now understand that you need to have a diversified portfolio. Within that, you need a global equity portfolio. Now, there's plenty of good global equity managers. We can help you with that if you want to. But around that, people are now starting to add low correlated, higher sources of alpha adding things. Satellite portfolios. It could be a BRIC fund. It could be global agribusiness. It could be gold and precious metals. It might be a Vietnam fund. It could be a biotech fund. They're all things that as you look forward, you can see if you look at global shares generally, these are something that seem very obvious to have a higher source of alpha above and beyond that benchmark, the MSCI World Index. So that's the way we think it fits into portfolios. It's not something you go out and put all your clients' money into by any stretch of the imagination. Have one or two core managers, but around that, look to put some more of the portfolio, smaller amounts obviously, into something that's going to have a lower correlation with global shares, but something that's got that extra alpha opportunity. And if we look at extra alpha, I mean, this fund's generated, I was looking at the end of July, in US dollar terms, we basically had 34% in just under 2 years excess return above and beyond the MSCI World Index. So there's plenty of opportunity for alpha. Has it all gone? I don't think so. If we look at the statistics for our portfolio, it's basically trading at about the same time as the MSCI World Index in terms of PE. But our earnings per share growth over the next year, we have roughly 18% earnings per share growth. The MSCI is looking like it's got about 10.8% earnings per share growth. So I think the world doesn't yet understand this. They haven't priced this appropriately. And that means that there's still opportunities to add alpha going forward. Long answer to your question. Thank you. We might take the microphones down because I think this is being recorded. Who's next?
Oh, okay, sorry.
Could you please assess the risk that public policy poses in the choice of its climate change mitigation regimes, of which there are many, the impact of that on the economics of conducting agriculture and whether or not the market will pay?
Well, I guess it depends how it's done. If it's all-encompassing and it's priced in the form of taxes and things like this the market pays. If you're talking about flatulence and cows, that's an entirely different thing. I think that the whole climate change thing is something that has to be solved, but it can't be done just by one country at a time. It requires global action on this. I mean, we could talk forever about this, but we've exported our manufacturing to countries like China, so that countries like Australia is no longer a heavy polluter itself, but the coal and everything else we send over there is causing this pollution. So we have an obligation somehow to help China and these other countries clean this up, because they simply can't afford to. Now, I don't know how that's going to happen. And agribusiness is a similar sort of thing. We've got sustainability issues with some of the practices that occur in agriculture. There's ethical issues with modified seeds. All of these things make it an interesting topic of discussion. But it's very difficult to see how some of these things will interact with climate change. But I can tell you now, the subsidies and tariffs that are involved need to be abolished to make a level playing field, and that's something that can actually reduce food prices globally.
Thank you. Just wanted to ask you on biofuels. I mean, to what extent is it competitive now to use food stuff for making fuels, or is this being encouraged through subsidies, etc.? Obviously, as the fuel price increases, it becomes more profitable to convert food stuff into fuels. But I suspect there's a lot of subsidy going in to encourage that right now.
There has been subsidy. You're absolutely correct. In the United States, it's subsidized, and seed production in Europe is also subsidized, rapeseed and these sorts of things. It's difficult to say how much it is, but about 6 months back, it was economically rational, and I use the term loosely, to produce ethanol from corn when the oil price was above $50 US a barrel. So you can see there's a lot of leeway there. But ethanol isn't one of the best sources of fuel. It's difficult to transport. It's corrosive. You need special pipes. You need special trucks with lined tanks. And it's actually probably generating more greenhouse gases in producing it than it's saving. It is renewable. It does have that option. But we would prefer to see ethanol made from wood waste, cellulosic ethanol. That requires a bit more research in terms of enzymes. It's an interesting science as we go forward. And we will see more of this happen, I'm sure. But at the moment, it's very obvious that ethanol production is driving up the cost of food, and it's affecting the world's poor and starving. There's no doubt about that.
One of the effects of climate change is the water crisis we've got on the Murray at the moment. And I bought that theme that I thought soft commodities would go up, and I invested in a few agribusiness companies. But because of the situation on the Murray, water allocations being cut back, you've got the government in there buying back water allocations. Do you have a view on how that's going to play itself out? What's going to happen there with just the fact that the water isn't available, the government's buying back allocations, and all these agribusiness companies that are in the Murray, what's going to happen to them? Do you have a view, and are they do you make space for them in your portfolios?
We run a global portfolio, and the whole reason for doing that, it gives you plenty of places to hide. And I sympathise with your investments, sir, but I think it looks a little tough for some of those companies, clearly. The government has an agenda. There's a green agenda. Gee, there's votes in it. So they're going to pursue it. We do obviously have problems with the Murray-Darling River system. It starts in Queensland. We all know this. There's no news in that. It's something that we'll just have to watch what Peter Garrett and others do to solve that problem. But the reason we have a global fund is that we want to have places to hide. We want to have different exposure to different countries. And basically, if there is another El Nino effect in Australia, it's going to affect Incitec Pivot in Australia. They'll sell less fertilizer. We'll have longer drought. The converse of that is that in Brazil, when that happens, they're actually advantaged. They get more rain. So we can shift the portfolio to fertilizer providers to Brazilian farmers, then we can do well that way. Or if there's something happening in Brazil, the US or Europe is favored. So we've got plenty of places to hide in all of this, and it's one of the advantages of not just investing in one country.
Thank you, Bill. I just have a question, just to follow through from the issues that's been raised so far. You've painted a very good case to stay globalized in agribusiness. I just want to know, I know that you've only been around a very short period of time, and there's really no index as such to measure you against, but what kind of standard deviation is your fund exhibiting to date?
That's a great question. I don't have that figure here. It is a global equity portfolio. It's a subset of global equities. It's therefore been slightly more volatile than global equities. So I think the US dollar standard deviation for the MSCI World Index, no, Australian dollars, is now around about 12.8, 13 times. Our portfolio is probably around about 13.2 times, but I'd have to check that. That's off the top of my head. We have had a lower beta than the global market. According to Bloomberg, if you look at the fund, the beta of the fund's been about 0.7. So when you look at that extra alpha that we've added over the 2 years, we've had a very, very high information ratio. Question here.
Bill, in your agribusiness definition, do you also include forestry? And if so, sort of what extent of your portfolios?
We can include forestry. At the moment, we have about 122 stocks in the portfolio. Two of those would relate to forestry industries. Yeah.
Because of a particular
view? It's usually related to price. We want to construct a portfolio. We're quite ambivalent as to where stocks are. We just invest in companies. We construct a portfolio. We want to have it diversified. We have about 120 stocks in the portfolio. We want to get alpha from a great number of stocks every month, not just from one or two big positions. So we diversify it, and we construct the portfolio so the stocks that we see as having the most upside get the biggest weights in the portfolio. So that dictates what we own. We start with a universe now that's got about 1,000 companies that get most of their income from agribusiness pursuits. We break that down further. So we add about another 150 names that have a less tenuous link to agribusiness. A good example would be a company like Mahindra & Mahindra, an Indian company. It's an auto manufacturer. They make a significant number of tractors. It's a growing part of their business, and they're exporting them around the world. So we add about 150 companies like that. We then cull that down. We go down to about 200 million in market cap. We avoid investment in some countries, such as Zimbabwe, for instance, at the moment. We monitor Zimbabwe very closely, but at the moment we're not investing there. We also look at company management. We want to make sure that companies aren't suppressing the rights of shareholders where there's a family interest. That culls that down to about 650-odd companies. We then get stuck into that with research. We're able to do that. We've got 74 analysts around the world. We can break that down to about 250 companies that form an alpha pool. And then we really tear those apart, rank them by upside, optimize to make sure the companies with the most upside get the biggest weights. As companies approach that upside, we sell them and put in something that's got more upside. And that's just an ongoing process. Long answer, but I hope it covers what you wanted.
Bill, with the soft commodity prices, how do you get exposure to that? Obviously not directly to the commodity itself, but how can you actually leverage that in the portfolio?
Well, there's some companies that have exposure to it. One of the larger portfolio positions would be Archer Daniels Midland, ADM, as it's known in the US. Basically, they're vertically integrated across the whole production cycle. So they actually produce corn. They sell seed to farmers. They use that corn to make cornstarch, corn syrup. They feed corn to chickens. They use corn to produce ethanol. So you can get exposure to that. There's another company called Corn Products International, which has recently had a takeover bid from another company we own called Bunge. Bunge does the same sort of things, but across the soybean cycle. They're basically very much focused on Latin America. So you can pick companies that have got direct commodity exposure there. For instance, last year the sugar price collapsed, but it came back quite substantially. We thought that was overdone, so we could shift weight to sugar producers. So we did that. We had some Thai companies, an English company, Tate and Lyle, that took over Bundaberg Sugar a few years ago, you may recall. So we were able to get exposure that way. So we can look at where prices are going. We actually had a view that commodities were overdone and were likely to come back. That's precisely what has happened. We're now starting to reweight to companies that have got a little bit more commodity exposure than we've had in the past. Is that?
Bill, a broader question on energy and the impact that that has on food. You have a particular global view on, around uranium and the impact that the nuclear industry might well be as a future trend over, say, the next 5 to 10 years.
Uranium and food, they're sort of contraindicated. As an investment manager, I guess we have a very strong view on uranium, and that is that I think uranium has a key part to play in the energy crisis. There's no doubt about that. But it is a major pollutant. It's a big problem. We also run a thematic climate change fund, and in that, because we have a lot of German and Japanese investors, nuclear energy is very much a no-no. So we've actually excluded nuclear energy from the climate change fund, but I would see that having a huge impact on energy as we go forward, because it is a source of clean energy in that it's not polluting with carbon dioxide pollutants. So I think nuclear energy has a part to play, but it's an expensive technology. Uranium's reasonably freely available. But it takes, you know, there's a lead time of 5 to 7 years typically to get nuclear plants up and running. So it's a longer term situation. As it affects agriculture, unless you have major pollution accidents that are going to affect agriculture, I don't see the link between the two, quite frankly.
Bill, thanks very much. I just had a question regarding government intervention into, in particular, water and food. Now, I think we'd all agree that they're essentials, and the whole ability to make profit out of them is based on demand and supply. When an essential becomes short in regard to its supply, governments intervene right around the world, as far as I can see, and I can't actually see that in the future, if those statistics are even half correct and the populations boom the way they are suggested they will, that government will just sit back and say, well, the rich can afford it, the poor will just die off, and that's the end of the... that's capitalism for you. Don't you see that... or do you believe that that's the demand-supply issue is going to create a significant problem, whether it's in a year of an election or anything else, because even the poor can vote?
Well, in some countries. Some countries, they can't vote. China, for instance. But basically, I agree with what you're saying. I'm not suggesting we're going to starve. We will increase the yield from agricultural land. It simply requires more investment. And that will happen. It's happening now. We're getting firms such as our own. We're interested in a global agricultural land fund, for instance. And that's looking to increase yield from land in areas where there's great land. That's a private equity sort of investment for high net worth individuals. But basically, there'll be more of these funds start, and you'll start to see more yield. There'll be a pickup in yield. We will grow more food. We'll continue to have improvements with seed technology. We'll continue to have better fertilizers. But to come back to your question, yes, there will be subsidies and things put in place. Countries like China cannot afford to have political instability. The whole thing works through political stability. It's now a one-party capitalist state. It's communist in name only. But the whole thing is going to be controlled by one party. So going forward, they must have stability. So if food prices do start to become untenable, they will freeze those. Now, that's just one part of the world, though. It doesn't mean that food prices and markets can't work in other parts. And because the fund's global in nature, as I said earlier, we've got plenty of places we can move to benefit from not so much rising food prices. This isn't about that. That's what commodity funds do. Commodity funds are basically, in some ways, immoral, at best amoral, because they are actually pushing up the price of food. A fund such as this is looking to solve the problems of many of this. We're investing in the technologies and companies that are trying to fix this problem. So there's a vast difference. But you are correct. There will be price ceilings put on in some countries. India, for instance, if there's another problem with rice, these sorts of things, they will have price controls. But as we come out of this, we have to move through and go beyond it. You know, right now, we've seen oil price rises in countries that have had subsidies, Indonesia, Malaysia, India to a lesser extent. Governments are spending billions and billions of dollars on this. They simply can't afford to. So long-term, these sort of things don't work, but they can be there as protection mechanisms to keep civil peace, basically. And that will happen from time to time as these things do get out of control. I'm sure that's correct.
Okay, we're going to have to wrap up the Q&A there. We're just going to hand over to Jody quickly to talk about the DWS product, and then we need to vote, and then you're free to go to the next session.
I think most of you will probably agree with me after listening to Bill talk this morning that there are significant structural issues at play which are influencing both the supply and the demand of agricultural products, and therefore leading to an increase in food prices. And that this increase in food prices is likely to be secular in nature. Because it's secular, it becomes investable. Now, it was mentioned again this morning in the keynote presentation that we all listened to that theme investing will become quite important in investors' portfolios to see us through this next phase of the markets, and in particular, to combat inflation. It's probably important to point out, though, that at the moment, if you're investing in global equity managers who are investing in accordance to the MSCI World Benchmark, your exposure to this agribusiness theme will be quite low. Hence why it's important to consider funds such as this agribusiness fund as satellite roles in your investment portfolio. Just to give you a bit of an idea of the level of investment opportunity that's available in this sector, we mentioned earlier there isn't an adequate benchmark to replicate the sector, so we've used our fund here as a proxy. Since inception, you can see that we've delivered 40% in performance relative to the MSCI World Benchmark over the same period, which has delivered less than 1%. This is for our US product, which has a longer performance history. The Australian fund, which was launched back in September 06, as you can see, has delivered fantastic performance even in these difficult financial markets. If you'd like to know more about the DWS Global Agribusiness Fund, please visit our stand down in the cafe downstairs and talk to somebody from our sales team. So I'd just like to thank you all firstly for joining us today, but in particular... Get out, Graham. Yeah, but if you can just join me in thanking Bill for his presentation as well.
Thanks,
Jody. Okay, and if everyone can put their smart cards in and vote.
Sorry to cut you off. That's all right. I thought we had them 5 past.
I know. Deirdre came in and said, oh, no, to cut it short.
So, oh, I see.
And I couldn't kind of tell you that mid...
That's all right. I finished with plenty of time for questions. So there's lots of questions.
The questions in a good. Way better. Like it gives you a chance to showcase.
Oh, hi, I'm Ruth Richardson.
Hi.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your question.
Speak to my heart. Now,
good.
Your graph on yields was counterintuitive, because what's happening is as you're getting higher yield from less available land. Is that what you were trying to say?
No, the yields are still in